Good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, investigator reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us, followed by Conversations with Linda. Here's what's happening. A strain of genetically modified wheat developed in the United Kingdom has failed to repel pests as intended in field trials. Scientists had wanted to engineer a variety with an odor that kind of deterred aphids. While it worked in the lab out in the field, the wheat was still attacked by the pests. The wheat trial was the subject of protests by anti-GM campaigners in 2012. An opposition group said the outcome was further evidence of the folly of investing in GM technology is not working there. Police have been criticized for perceived acts of brutality, and America's confidence in police has fallen in recent months to a 22-year low, according to Gallup. At the same time, the polling outlet was very quick to point out that even at its currently reduced confidence level, the police are still among the highest-ranking institutions, trailing only the military, small business, among the 15 institutions tested in that poll. A young mother says a husband and wife brutally assaulted her in an unprovoked road rage incident in California. She said that a 39-year-old and his wife traumatized her over 2 miles while she was driving home from work. They cut her off initially, and then they began repeatedly slamming on their brakes in front of her. She said she was trapped in between two cars when the couple got out of their car and started to fight with her, swinging and punching her through her window. What's happening with road rage? People are going crazy. Let's check in with the birthday boy, Howard Bloom. Happy birthday, first of all, Howard.
George, a huge thanks. Well, what's going on here? Basically, road rage is increasing 57% in the last year in England. There is a new phenomena in Russia. People buy dash cams because the police there can be easily bribed. Now, if you get into an auto accident, the person that caused the accident, not you, is able to pay a bigger bribe than you can. The policeman will swear that it's your fault. So people have been buying dash cams. The result is that dash cam footage of people attacking each other in road.
Howard, you still there? Oh, no, we've lost the birthday boy right in the middle of that great thing. Well, we're talking about road rage, and it just seems to be going like crazy. Severe storms going on out there, by the way, in the Midwest. I don't think if it had anything to do with our phone, but I hope Howard is okay. He lives out in the New York area. So just be careful when you're out there. I've always believed that road raging has to do a lot with the person who is confronted by a bad driver, and then they're in a bad mood, and they go crazy. But I think we got Howard back. What the heck happened to you, Howard?
God knows. We lost the connection. But here's the deal. There's something in psychology called the frustration-aggression hypothesis. It was developed in the 1940s by guys named Dollard and Miller. You run a rat down a bowling alley-like maze, and it gets food at the other end. Once it gets really used to getting the food, it knows that once it gets into that particular little bowling alley, it's going to be fed. You put a little electrified grid in front of the food. So the rat goes running down the maze to get the food, and all of a sudden, wham, it runs into an obstacle. It runs into pain. Now, what does it do? If you give it another rat, it will beat the heck out of that other rat. It's not just us, not just us humans, who take out our frustration by pounding away with aggression at our fellow human beings as drivers. Now, what do we buy cars for? To have a sense of control. Every ad you've ever seen has a car out in the open road with absolutely nothing in the way. People, automobile manufacturers would not be able to sell cars if they showed pictures of us mired in traffic. So we expect to have total control in an open road. We get nothing of the sort. We get bogged down in a long 5-mile-an-hour parking lot, and we get frustrated with each other. And just like the rats, we take out our aggression on our fellow human beings. And it doesn't just happen here. It happens in England. It happens in Australia. Recent polls in England and Australia demonstrate that their rates of road rage are up. It happens wherever there are automobiles. And as I said, it's a new fad in Russia to watch YouTube videos from dash cams of people attacking each other with the wildest instruments you can imagine. There are two swimmers who were driving in Denmark. Now, you would think Copenhagen, Denmark would be the safest place in the world from road rage. The people there are very calm. There's very little violence in Denmark. No, these two ran into a road rage incident, and the guy who attacked them with flying jiu-jitsu kicks. These are two Olympic swimmers, and they were injured so badly that they were told they could not swim for 2 weeks, and there was a major international meet coming up.
Howard, so you're spot on in terms of why people are upset. They're aggressive, and after you were cut off, I was mentioning that I think the driver, something happens with the bad driver, and they go crazy. The other driver just goes nuts. Well, thanks a lot. There's a little town in Vermont called Williston. A half-a-century-old gun club there is suing the town of Williston over noise ordinance citations, which owners say violate members' gun rights. The North Country Sportsmen's Club has filed a lawsuit in response to incidents in which Williston police tried to shut down routine shooting sport activities in May. So let's see what happens there. The top executives of many a corporate giant must feel like the fictional character Gulliver, waking up to find themselves under attack from modern-day Lilliputians, small startup companies which overwhelm their established rivals with new technologies. The old powers of market incumbents, massive scale control, overdistribution, brand power, millions of customer relationships are no longer seen as the obstacles they once were to agile rivals with innovative business models. A new survey finds that business leaders believe 4 out of 10 top-ranked companies in their industries worldwide will not survive the next 5 years. They blame the accelerating change in technology, shifting business models, and a need to merge to cut costs in order to ensure that they don't become footnotes in someone else's corporate history. Let's check in with Catherine Austin Fitz on how the Internet seems to be wiping out mainstream businesses. And Catherine, I noticed this week Facebook, at least with the stock market, is valued more than Walmart.
I know. There you go.
Jeez.
Well, it doesn't have all those expenses.
No, it's not bricks and mortar. You don't have to worry about any of that.
Yeah, it's not bricks and mortar. But, George, it's called creative destruction, and we're seeing enormous creative destruction in the economy. And, of course, it's one of the things that's bringing out the push for more and more people to run to Washington to get the rules rigged in their favor. All the efforts we've seen to push bills through controlling the Internet, I'll never forget. I asked a question at a conference once of the former head of the CIA, and he got so upset for 2 weeks he kept talking about, we have to regulate the Internet. But it's natural. People are afraid of change, and if you're running an operation, you've got a big overhead, you've got people who work for you. It's easy to get afraid in this environment, but it really requires innovation and making sure that I call it jumping the curve. So just as a startup is taking new technology and pulling the rug out from under you, you have to listen to that, and you need to grab the new technology and do the same. So it's what somebody said, let's do new Coke before, somebody else does it to us.
You got that right.
Coke has to do new Coke before the startup does it to Coke.
Follow Catherine by going to her website at Solari.com. Listen to this one. Police in central England have warned locals to beware of a large 6-foot-tall aggressive bird which has gone on the run. Yeah, I just about can't believe it. It's called a rhea, which is a tall, flightless bird native to South America. Went missing from a private collection. It's not been seen since, but they've been onward. It's very aggressive. It looks like one of those Velociraptor dinosaurs or something that you'll see in Jurassic World. As expected, a coronal mass ejection hit Earth's magnetic field. At first, the impact had little effect, but now a G2-class geomagnetic storm is in progress as Earth passes through the CME's wake. The intensity of the storm is hard to predict, so we'll see what happens there. Hundreds of protesters on a Hawaii mountain road erupted in cheers after construction crews turned around and retreated from the site for what would be one of the world's largest telescopes. The billion-dollar project has drawn intense opposition from native Hawaiians who say the 18-story observatory on the Big Island's Mauna Kea would desecrate land that they considered sacred. We'll see what happens there. 68 years ago, Kenneth Arnold spotted 9 unusual objects flying in a chain near Mount Rainier, Washington. Up next, we'll talk about that incredible story on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. 68 years ago, an individual by the name of Kenneth Arnold was flying near Mount Rainier in Washington. He spotted 9 very strange objects reported as unidentified. From that moment, the term flying saucer was created. This hour, we are going to talk with the granddaughter of Kenneth Arnold, Chanel Shenz. Chanel, of course, is the granddaughter. She has had extensive experience talking about her grandfather. She's from Boise, Idaho, and is on Coast to Coast. And it's just a pleasure to talk with you, Chanel. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, good evening, George. I feel very honored to be on Coast to Coast. It was great to meet you last year.
It was fun. I liked it. I had a great time there.
Yeah.
What's it like to be Kenneth Arnold's granddaughter?
Well, I mean, I grew up looking through a lot of interesting documents, and you know, I knew my grandfather until he passed away, and I just loved him so much and was always so proud of him.
Yeah, he passed away in 1984. And during the course of time that you knew him, Chanel, or when your family members might have talked about him, did the story of these UFOs pop up a lot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a ufologist named Pierre Lagrange that came from France, and he was one of the last people to interview him. And, you know, he had multiple sightings throughout his life, but his most famous one happened on June 24th, 1947.
Let's talk a little bit about what your grandfather reportedly told everybody. You know, we've always been told he saw 9 unusual objects, but what did he really say to the family?
Oh, well, I mean, he definitely, you know, saw what he saw. He was a pilot and was very knowledgeable on speed, and this happened during a time of war, you know, just 23 months after Hiroshima was bombed. And, you know, when he saw how fast they were going, he clocked them at going about 1760 miles per minute, which was unheard of back then with no tails. You know, he thought they were Russian military intelligence. Mm-hmm. He didn't know exactly, you know, what he had seen. You know, he just, as a pilot, he knew he had to report it.
And of course, from that point on, the term flying saucer came out. And did he feel as if the field of ufology was important? Was he convinced that you know, as you mentioned, he thought maybe the Russians were doing this, the Soviets at the time. Did he ever change his mind? Did he ever think, oh, maybe these things are coming from out of space?
He believed they're multidimensional, definitely by the end of his life. He believed they're multidimensional. And, you know, it was almost like a spiritual experience for him because, you know, he had seen something so incredible that, you know, it was really hard for him to come out with that when he made the report in Pendleton when he landed. He first landed in Yakima and discussed it, and then by the time he got to Pendleton, all the reporters wanted to know what he saw. And that's when it hit the papers. And this all happened about 2 weeks before the Roswell incident happened.
That's right. And the timing is so unusual, isn't it? Did he ever change his story?
I mean, the reason why he was actually he was doing business. He was a fire safety salesman. He was doing business in Chehalis, Washington, and he was going to Yakima, Washington. And so he was flying near Mount Rainier where it crashed military marine transport plane had crashed, and there was a $5,000 reward to find it. And he looked for it for about an hour, and then turned in the direction of Yakima, and then he started seeing bright flashes in his cockpit. And he looked around. He saw a plane in the very far distance, probably flying to California. And then he saw the flash again. It was so bright that he just lit up his cockpit. And then he finally saw these 9 UFOs that he described like saucers skipping on water when he made the report in Pendleton that the term flying saucers was coined. But they were also, you know, kind of boomerang shaped and mm-hmm. flying like a flock of geese, you know, and that's kind of common with modern sightings, seeing like a triangle right. shape of, you know, UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've also heard about the Gillihan Ranch in Mount Adams and how there's a lot of sightings.
Lots
there.
Up there. Yep. Many yeah. sightings up. And your grandfather was a very experienced pilot.
Oh, yeah. So, he had to do everything by hand, you know, to calculate the speed and altitude. He was flying about 9,000 feet, you know, and he first clocked their speed at like 1,200 miles per minute, but then he recalculated it and it was about 1,760 miles per minute. Which
that's pretty darn fast. That is very fast. That's faster than a rocket ship, just about, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Well, did he ever feel as if he had wished that he didn't go public with this?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
He got all sorts of correspondence from people all over the world that had similar experiences. And Bruce McAbee, who's been on the show, he
yeah.
wrote this great article about how people were actually in the spring and summer of 1947, they were seeing all sorts of objects, but they just, nobody was credible enough to really make a report on, you know, what they were seeing. And so, and then, you know, on the 21st of June, the Maury Island incident happened. And my grandfather became involved in that investigation, and that turned into a pretty big ordeal. But Ray Palmer contacted my grandfather after his sighting and started working with him for Fate magazine.
That's right.
And my grandfather did an article with him. And Ray Palmer actually heard about the Maury Island incident and reimbursed him to go to Tacoma to investigate it with some military officials. And the guy whose last name was Dahl that originally saw this UFO crash had parts of it. They all met at a hotel room in Tacoma, and my grandfather swore it was bugged. And it just seemed too, I don't know, Dahl was supposedly visited by a man in black who threatened him. I'm sure you've heard this story before.
Well, that's okay. Some of our listeners haven't, and I find it really refreshing. Was your grandfather ever threatened or anything like that?
There was a story of later on that a man in black in a black old sedan came to visit him, drove him out, and said, you know, you need to be quiet if you care about your family. And that's usually how it goes with those experiences. And, you know, my grandfather just was so frustrated by the end of his life. He had a friend in the military give him a reel-to-reel of a UFO in the sky. He sent it into the government and said, explain this. They cut out the footage of the UFO, sent it back to him, and said, nothing's there.
And kept the good stuff.
Yeah, and this is back before computers and where you could scan stuff. You know, he sent in the actual footage.
Oh,
you know, and he was just so frustrated because he never was getting any straight answers from the government. He was the guest speaker for the UFO Congress in Chicago in 1977.
Oh, yeah. He was in his day, he was a giant by those people who believed in UFOs. Stick around. We'll come back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the modern field of ufology started 68 years ago with the incredible sightings by pilot Kenneth Arnold, and his granddaughter is with us to talk more and take some of your phone calls when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, Chanel Shands with us, granddaughter of Kenneth Arnold. How do you feel about that, Chanel, the fact that people introduce you as Kenneth Arnold's granddaughter? You're proud about that, I guess.
I am. I've always been proud. When I was in the second grade, I told my teacher about my grandfather, and she's like, oh, that's so sweet, honey, but that was way before ancient aliens. You know, it was before it was even, you know, discussed, and it wasn't really even discussed that much in the 80s, so early 80s.
Well, his sighting really kicked off the field of modern-day ufology because, as you mentioned, just several weeks later, we had the Roswell episode, and isn't it unusual that he would see 9 strange objects in Washington, and then in New Mexico, we'd get the Roswell crash? Something weird here. There might have been a tie-in. You know, I don't believe in coincidences. There's something going on here, and the fact that the government was able to pounce on this quickly to try to keep him quiet and everything else. But he didn't, as you said. He didn't stay quiet. You know, he wrote a book with Ray Palmer from Fate magazine. He went to UFO conventions. He got into this in a big way, didn't he?
Oh, he did. He felt like it was his purpose in life to figure out what it really was. Because, you know, the government always denied it, and there's still today a problem with disclosure, and, you know, I've just grown up with it all my life, and I've met a lot of people in the UFO field. I'm pretty close to the Marcel grandchildren, Denise and Jesse III, and, of course, their father passed away, and they're going to have, this year, for the Roswell festival, they're going to honor Jesse Jr. Marcel, you know, and Denise and Jesse will be there in Roswell, which I wish I could be there with them. But, you know, I met Paula Harris on your show calling in.
Yeah,
on the anniversary,
right.
And you know, I've just enjoyed being in this field all my life and being exposed to all the documents that I've been exposed to. He got all sorts of interesting correspondence and you know, definitely some interesting pictures of odd things, and people would just send him all sorts of stuff, and I have the privilege to look through the files, you know.
That's exciting. A long time ago in a far-off land, there was a great late-night talk show host by the name of Long John Neville, who was on the station I'm on in New York right now, WOR, and he was the pioneer in this business. I mean, he was the one who truly got this going, and he talked about the unusual and UFOs. Do you know if he ever had a chance to interview your grandfather?
I don't think so.
That would have been a great interview. I would have loved to have interviewed your grandfather just to chat with him about what he saw. And, you know, he was a pilot, so he doesn't make mistakes. And, you know, a lot of people had said, no, they're just anomalies or weather inversions or clouds. I don't think so. Clouds don't go 1,700 miles a minute, do they?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, he, later in life, even got into politics and ran for lieutenant governor, met President Eisenhower, and he also ran for Congress as well, because he kind of, you know, he wanted to figure out what was going on, you know, and he thought politics was the way to possibly, you know, and he had a lot of friends. Captain E.J. Smith was a pilot that saw UFOs here in Idaho, and he was good friends with him. He met him with the Maury Island incident that happened, that the investigation happened, and that was pretty odd because 2 military officials ended up crashing with fragments of the UFO supposedly came from Maury Island, and they were my grandfather's friends. On the way to a base in California, Captain William Davison and Lieutenant Frank Brown. And then when my grandfather tried to leave, he wanted to get out of the investigation because he just felt like it was getting, you know, too risque. His plane ceased when he left the ground, and he thought his pistons weren't working, and he carefully landed, investigated his plane, and his fuel line was turned off.
Wow. Somebody tried to do him in.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was right after, you know, his friends had perished.
He had four daughters, Kiska, Carla, Kim, and April. Which one was your mother?
Kim.
Kim. And through his entire life, you know, he would begin to tell people about his episode. And most people believed him, didn't they?
Oh, he was an honest man. He was an Eagle Scout. He had been flying since he was 16. He was deputy sheriff for Ada County's, Idaho's aerial posse and relief deputy for the federal U.S. Marshals, and flew prisoners up to McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary. I mean, he was very creditable.
Yeah, he sold fire suppression equipment when he was flying around, and that's how this happened. Hey, let's take a few calls here for you. Chanel, let's go to Kirsten in Aberdeen, Washington. Welcome to the program, Kirsten. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, George. This is such an exciting night for me. Chanel, my dad, I'm connected to you in the same story. My dad owned a business, the first concession business in Mount Rainier National Park called Sparks and Anderson. On the day that your dad saw them, my dad saw them.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. I think I read about that.
You did?
Wait a second. Let me look at my book. I think I read about that. He saw the same things that my grandfather saw. I know I did read about that. That is awesome.
It was my dad, and he came home the following week. Whenever he was coming back home, he'd call my mom and say, okay, Ann, I'm coming down from the mountain, and he'd come home. But mom said, I remember the stories because we loved hearing it, and he described them as being silver and just brilliant looking, and the horses went crazy. He could barely contain them, and he was an expert horseman, expert. But he had a heck of a time with them. At first, he thought maybe it was a cougar because they don't get upset so much at bears as they do at cougars. And also, there were rattlesnakes in the park, which a lot of people didn't know. They kept that one kind of quiet. But it was a remarkable tale that he told. And my mom said that he remained quite unsettled for quite a few weeks after. He said it was the most incredible thing he'd ever seen. And then he was familiar also with the war stories about Foo Fighters.
That's right.
And so he wondered, he told mom, he wondered if that was possibly what he had witnessed. And it made him think that he was inclined then to believe what our Air Force had seen during the Second World War over in Germany and other places. But I'm so excited. We both grew up with the same story, and it's just so neat that you're on. Thank you for her, George.
Oh, thank you for calling us in. What a great story that was. So here we are now, Chanel, with two different people, your grandfather, her father, witnessing the same thing. That's amazing. That is just truly amazing. Let's go to Dean in Santa Rosa, California. Dean's a first-time caller. Hey, Dean, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, George. Evening, Chanel. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I just wanted to give you a piece of information, kind of a color for the story. Is I listen to you on Sirius XM, and when you're not on, I flip the channels, and I was hit a radio station called Radio Classics. You had an episode on them talking about the old radio series that this guy plays. He was a guest in your program once.
Right.
And he was playing an episode of a Charlie McCarthy, Edgar Bergen, dated from February 7th, 1947.
Uh-huh.
And in that particular episode, he was telling Charlie a story about Aladdin, and Aladdin met this sorcerer, And Charlie happened to make the joke. He goes, was it a flying sorcerer? With a whole lot of emphasis on the word flying and twisting the pronunciation sorcerer. And I immediately, you know, waited till the end of the program to write the date down. And I thought it might be something that you would want to, you know, keep in your little tidbit file as to there was actually telling jokes about this subject that far back.
I love that. We'll do that, Dean. Thank you. And Chanel, in terms of the term flying saucer, did your dad come up with that or did the media do that?
Well, it was how he described him to a reporter in Pendleton. He described him like a saucer if you would skip it across the water, and that's how the term was coined. So it's not like he didn't say, I saw flying saucers. It was the way he described them.
Next up, Mary is in Westwood, New Jersey. Go ahead, Mary. Thanks for calling us.
Hi, George. Hi, Chanel.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you that my very close relative of mine had worked for NASA for many, many decades, and he's 83 now and retired not too long ago and still does some consulting for them. And he never ever talked about his work, but he had very high clearance, and he was at the point where they wanted him to go before Congress to be voted into a higher position there, but he turned it down because if they can vote him in, they could also vote him out. So I didn't see him very often, but he came up with his wife. We were all sitting around, and I thought, hey, well, I was a lot younger, so I didn't really go about it the right way, but I was never really into UFOs, but wanted to ask him about Area, 51, 52, 52?
Area 51, yeah.
Area 51. Well, I got to tell you, his face changed. He was not happy at me asking him that at all. He was very disturbed and actually didn't know what to say, but he did not want to talk about it. And I found that quite interesting, but I guess he is taught there that they cannot tell you anything, really, much of anything, unless it's something that the public already knows. I mean, he worked on the first, space shuttle, and he also, mm-hmm. also worked on one of the first satellites that were sent up. So he did a lot of work there, and I was wondering, is there like any specific way, if I ever talk to him again, how to go about talking to him about things like that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, one thing I would do is study up on a lot of the things we've been doing. There's a lot of information, for example, on Chanel's grandfather. If you just go to the website, put in Kenneth Arnold, and it all keeps coming up. He's got a lot of notoriety out there, Chanel.
Oh, yeah.
He's one of a kind.
He was just like, you know, the perfect person to report the sighting. You know, there wasn't a lot of pilots flying around back in 1947.
No, not at all.
You know, couldn't afford airplanes. And my grandfather was just he was a businessman and was successful and was able to own two Call-Air airplanes and you know, definitely was creditable. So,
are you the one carrying the torch now for the family with this story?
Oh, my mom and I both are. I mean, we had a good experience with the 701 movie in California. That was a lot of fun. I got to meet Travis Walton, which, I mean, was just like, that was just awesome. And then to meet Stanton Freeman with you was an honor, because he actually met my grandfather. And there's not a lot of people left that have met my grandfather. You know, and he met him at the UFO Congress the year I was born, in 1977, in Chicago.
Stan goes back so far, I think he's met some of the original astronauts from the Egyptian pyramid era. I love the guy. He's one of a kind. He really is.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's amazing. You know, we just had the anniversary on June 24th, the 68th anniversary of your grandfather's sighting. Mm-hmm. And it really, I think it rocked the world in those days, because the media at that time seemed to be more into these stories than they are today, and they took it seriously.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you know, nowadays, if a pilot would say, hey, well, I saw nine objects, I don't know how the media would react to that anymore. Was your father glad that he went public with it?
He felt like it was his duty, especially if it was, you know, some threat to our country. I mean, he was quite, you know, he'd never seen anything fly so fast. And, you know, pilots are supposed to report what they see. And, you know, of course, there's stories of pilots that have reported UFOs, and all of a sudden they're not pilots anymore because
that's,
you know,
right,
they're seeing things, even though there's witnesses that see it too. I mean, it scares pilots.
Some of the air traffic controllers say to the pilots, okay, so do you want to report this? And the pilots will look at each other with the co-pilot and come back and say, no. That happens a lot. Let's go to Greg in New Jersey. Greg, welcome to Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, George, and thank you for being there. Somebody had just mentioned Foo Fighters, which stirred my memory of how I had asked my grandfather one day, who was the intelligence officer for the 384th Bomber Group, about Foo Fighters. And my uncle was, you know, quick to change the subject. And over the years, I had thought back upon it, and it was just after I had read that book by Timothy Good, Above Top Secret.
Yes.
And, I was just wondering about how many people have been able to figure out what those Foo Fighters were doing. You know, why were they, it's obvious they were trying to check out, you know, what was going on in the war. But
it's kind of funny. The Germans originally thought that they were ours. We thought that they were the Germans, and nobody ever figured it out. And in the Foo Fighters, of course, the people are saying, what the heck are they talking about? Were supposed to be the smaller sized objects which were seen flying next to our planes during World War II, and German planes as well. And nobody was ever able to figure them out. They weren't particularly large. They might have been a couple feet long, but they were all over the place. That, too, an incredible story. So, Chanel, as far as you're concerned, what are you doing these days?
I just enjoy my family and happily married, and eventually I want to write a book. I just need to make the right connections. There's not a lot of people you can trust, you know, and
that's true.
A lot of people want stuff for free, and what I have access to is pretty rare and very interesting. And I mean, there's been times where I had a friend work for a radio station, and I think I had a copy of Project Blue Book that was declassified, and it had a lot of information about UFOs and aliens, and we just passed it around the radio station. You know.
Well, I tell you what, one of my old partners in a couple of my books, Bill Burns, is a great writer on UFOs. He ran UFO Magazine with his wife Nancy, and also wrote the book The Day After Roswell, the story with Philip Corso. Stay in touch with us, and I'll get you some of his email information. He'd be a great co-author with you in this field. As a matter of fact, he just had a UFO book that just came out. We're going to come back in a moment. Linda Moulton Howe joins us, the investigative reporter, next.